Celtic Connections, the show with the Catholic view of what's happening right now in Great Britain, in Ireland, and across Europe. Celtic Connections with Cathy Sinnott. Broadcasting from Ireland.
Hello and welcome to Celtic Connections. I'm Cathy Sinnott and I'm coming to you from Cork in Ireland. Blessed Silanus Casey, Capuchin Friar, is one of the most beloved of Catholic blesseds in the United States. Today, we're going to tell you the little-known story of Father Silanus Casey's Irish roots. In fact, his mother and father both came from Ireland and left during the famine years of the 1840s. Brother Richard Merlin is the postulator for the cause of Silanus Casey. So together with Silanus' grandniece, Sister Anne Herkenrath, Brother Richard came to Ireland from the United States to present a series of talks on the life and the Irish roots of Silanus Casey. Paul Macri met up with him during their visit. We begin today's show with a talk given by Father Richard in the very parish in Ireland, St. Malachy's Church, Camla, County Armagh, where Silanus Casey's mother, Ellen Murphy, grew up.
It is a pleasure to be here and to be able to speak to you folks who are from one of the parishes of Blessed Silanus Casey's parents. And it is a delight to be here and very special. You might say this is where it began to a certain extent with his parents from this wonderful country of Ireland. And of course, as you may know, that then they went on over to the States in the early years. And they actually went over unknown to one another at the time. They ended up meeting at a parish picnic and began to date one another. And as they went along, they fell in love with one another. And in time, both of the members moved on out to the state of Wisconsin along the Mississippi River. And there they ended up coming to know one another again there and end up marrying. Of course, they started off with farming, and they ended up with a family of some 16 children. And Father Silanus was the sixth oldest of the children. And with that, of course, all of the children had to work very hard and so forth. And Silanus, or rather Bernard Casey at the time, ended up looking for work as a young teenager, and he left school early and went off to work in the city so that he might be able to earn some money for the family and their needs. And as time went on, Bernard, one of the jobs that he had was as a streetcar conductor. And at that time, he experienced a very tragic thing that happened, a stabbing of a young lady, and he witnessed that. And it was very shocking to him. At the time, he was around 19 years of age, and with that traumatic thing happening in his life, he really felt that he needed to dedicate his life to God and helping other people out. And so with that, he ends up inquiring about going on to the seminary, and he ends up going to the seminary, and there he spends some 5 years struggling through the seminary in Milwaukee, which was of a German background. And so he really struggled with the language. And at the end of the 5 years, they kind of suggested that maybe he would go on to some other diocese to go on for priesthood. And with that, he didn't know where to go. So he ends up making a great novena to the Blessed Virgin. And he ends up making that novena so that it would end on December the 8th. And he really felt that the ninth day of his novena, he heard a voice from the Blessed Virgin saying to him, "Go to Detroit, go to Detroit." And Detroit was where the Capuchins were. And so he ends up joining the Capuchins. But again, they were of a German background, and he struggled with the language. And so at the end of his 8 years of seminary, again, because of the language, they kind of felt, well, maybe there were things that he didn't understand and everything in the line of some of his studies and that. And so they ordained him as a simplex priest, one who could simply say the Mass, but he could not hear confessions or preach publicly. And so with that, he was restricted. So when once he was ordained, he was sent out to a parish out in New York in Yonkers, Sacred Heart. And there he spent 13 years. In those 13 years, he began to really, you might say, blossom to be whom he was to be, a wonderful saintly person. And with that, people noticed that, and the superiors were very much attuned to what was happening there. And so they said, well, let's put him into another parish to where we can see if this will continue. So they did. They moved him into another parish, and he was spent 3 years there, and the same things were happening. So they said, well, let's put him in another parish. So they sent him on to another parish for 3 years out in New York. And as he spent 3 years there, the same things were happening. And being that the headquarters were back in Detroit, the provincial, the superior, said, let's bring him to Detroit and see if this continues. So they did. And just to kind of let you know that at the monastery there at St. Bonaventure's in Detroit, there were a number of people who would come, maybe 10 to 15 on a daily basis, would come into the monastery asking for masses to be said or prayers or so forth. Father Solanas, our house chronicler, writes in there, Father Solanas Casey has been here for 2 weeks. Our numbers have increased from 15 a day to well over 200 a day. Word of mouth got around that there was this holy and wonderful man of Solanas Casey there in Detroit. He was there for the next 20 years, and after his 20 years there, they moved him to retire him because he had then turned 75. And so they sent him out to Brooklyn, New York, and they kind of thought, well, he's not known there. Well, it didn't take but within 9 months, they decided we got to move him from here too if he's going to retire. So they moved him from there, and they moved him to Huntington, Indiana, a nice, quiet place right out in the country where not too many people would know where that place is at. Well, a couple weeks later, there were busloads that started coming in to Huntington, Indiana, to visit Father Solanas Casey. And so that was kind of his story, really, for the rest of his life, of always being there to help many people. He was moved back to Detroit in his last year of his life, and basically it was because of his health and so forth. And again, they just wanted to have somewhat of a control over the number of people coming in to see him. Well, at that time, during that period, I, in a personal way, was able to meet him and visit with him. The fact was that I have an older brother that had been in a serious auto accident, injured his leg to the point to where they were going to amputate it. My mother, of course, knowing of Father Solanas and the Casey family and so forth, said, let's go down and see Father Solanas. So we went down on a Sunday afternoon. It was the Sunday before Christmas of that year of 1956. And we were able to visit with him. We told him about my brother and his situation. And he said, oh, don't worry. Everything's going to be all right. Well, the next day when my mother went into the hospital, expecting my brother's leg to be amputated, the doctors came up and said, you know, we're not going to amputate that leg. We think it's going to be all right. And so again, it was another answer to prayer through Solanas Casey. And on a more personal level, I just wanted to mention to the fact that I really believe that's perhaps at the time when I got my vocation, at least my mother certainly thought it was. It was to the fact that when he visited with us, or we were visiting with him, he said, you know, he said, I play a violin. And he says, I just restrung my violin this morning. He said, I'd like to play a couple tunes for you. So we went off to his room and came back with his violin in hand and played several tunes for us. We thought it was wonderful. And so anyways, we ended up leaving. And then when I entered the order, I so proudly said to the rest of the friars, oh, I got to hear Father Solanas play the violin. And they all kind of said yes, and so did we. So he didn't play the best, but he enjoyed it. It was to his heart's content that he was able to play, and especially the Christmas carols that he played for us at that time. But very fortunately, though, as I entered into the order and later was transferred to Detroit as a friar, I was assigned to work with his cause for his canonization, and it's been a great delight and something very special to have been part of, to see the thousands of people that come there seeking his help, his intercession in their lives. And so he certainly has been a great and wonderful man, and we certainly are very thankful to God for giving him to us. And like I say, his faith was so trusting and confident in God, it was unbelievable. And he continues to be a great intercessor for many, many people who come there to the tomb of Solanus Casey. And so with that, I'd like to just complete that with that thought of his great gift of intercessory. And we are very grateful to have the man whose roots started here in Ireland. God bless.
We've just been listening to Brother Richard Merlin, who's the vice postulator for Solanus Casey, Blessed Solanus Casey. My name's Paul McAree. This is Celtic Connections. I'm talking to Brother Richard and Sister Anne Herkenrath, and both are visiting from the United States and have connections with Blessed Solanus Casey. And we're here in Lurgan Keel Kilcurry, near Dundalk, County Louth. And it's late on a Monday evening. And Sister, you've been giving talks all week.
Yes.
On this wonderful relation of yours, Solanus Casey. Could you tell us your connection to Solanus Casey?
I am a grandniece of Solanus Casey. His big brother, James, was my grandfather.
Wonderful, wonderful. So it's a very close connection with Blessed Solanus Casey. Now, his father was from down the road here in Monaghan, isn't that right?
His father, from yes, Bernard.
From Castle Blaney. A townland close to there.
Yes.
And his mother was from?
His mother was Ellen Murphy, and she was born in Camlaw and baptized in the St. Mary's Church in Mullabon.
In County Armagh. Just up the road. So he was what you would call a pedigree Irishman, Solanus Casey. And he's really one of the most, I suppose, treasured and well-known of the blesseds, or if we can say saints, in North America. Isn't that right, Solanus Casey?
It seems to be that way, doesn't it, brother?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, and how many years ago now since he died?
It's been 60 years.
60 years, extraordinary.
Yeah, he died in 1957.
Did they meet in Ireland, or they met in America?
No, they met in America. They went over at different times, maybe 4 or 5 years.
Do we know the circumstances that they left Ireland?
Well, I know that Bridget Shields Murphy and her two daughters and a son went at the same time, left because Michael Timothy Murphy had died in the famine sometime between 1842 and 1845.
Yeah.
And as far as Bernard James, his dad was killed by the Orangemen in a skirmish where he was defending the church.
Really? So, and the Orangemen, of course, would have been the sort of militant Protestants.
That's right.
Mostly in the north. So they were both, in a sense, refugees from Ireland in that.
Yes.
Then. And one from the famine and one escaping the strife.
They both landed in the Boston area.
Yeah. And where did they end up then in America?
Well, they ended up in Seattle, Washington.
Wow. Right on the other side of the United States.
That's right. My great-grandfather made shoes for the Union Army. And then after the Civil War was over, he went into the shoe business with his brother Terence. But it seems, according to the stories, that there were so many children without shoes, he took them on credit and to make shoes for the children. And for some reason, and somehow, the parents forgot to, or could not
couldn't
pay
afford
for them.
To pay for them, perhaps.
And
yeah.
So, pretty soon, the young Casey family couldn't afford to stay there either because he wasn't making any money. So, Ellen had two brothers in Wisconsin, and they said to come to Wisconsin. There was lots of land present that they could get to homestead. And so they did. And they had two children with them at that time. And then they went on to have a total of 16 children.
Sure, that's remarkable. And coming from Ireland, the faith would have been strong in the family in that sense. Oh. Do you know much about the faith life of the family at that time?
The faith life was very strong. They were a family that prayed together every night.
There was a story about when they left Ireland with regard to the faith. Could you tell us that story?
Well, I'm only hearing that now from you, Vera. And so I think maybe Vera better tell you.
Vera, do you want to tell us that story? Vera is our host here. You're a relation of this.
Yes, I would be a third cousin of the Stich. My father's second cousin, and I would be third cousin.
Wonderful. Mm-hmm. And you're hosting our friends here from the United States.
Yes, I'm the coordinator of the trip.
And we've learned a story about the departure from Ireland, which was back when?
Famine time, 1845, 1846. Yes.
And what was that story?
Well, he left Castleblaney with his sister Ellen to go to the United States from Liverpool. And the last words his mother said to him was, "Keep the faith, Barney."
Keep the faith, Barney.
Mm. That's what
and
I remember.
Barney was Solanus Casey's father.
Yes.
Bernard James.
And he was named after his father.
Mm.
That was his secular name, was Bernard, isn't that right?
Well, Barney, yes.
Yeah, which would have been Bernard.
It was
probably.
Bernard.
Yeah, sure. Sure.
But they called him Barney.
And the faith was strong in the Irish when they went abroad. I mean, there was, leaving in those circumstances especially, I'd say that the faith was very important to them.
And traveling to a new land under the circumstances that they did, with no money, no real plan.
Nobody to meet them on the
other
side.
Nobody to meet them. And it was
a perilous time.
It was very, very difficult.
Yeah, yeah. Because that's around the time of the coffin ships, even. With a lot of impoverished Irish going over, dying on the journey.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and really at that time, we had, I think, how many million emigrated from Ireland? I think it was 3 million emigrated from Ireland at that time. Mm-hmm. And 1 million died in the land. It was 8 million of a population. Was mm-hmm. reduced to about 4 million.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a terrible, terrible time that they went over. So you took us to Seattle and then to Wisconsin.
And then the Murphy brothers invited them to come to Wisconsin.
And who were the Murphy brothers?
Ellen Murphy, Casey's brothers.
Okay.
And they were farming in Wisconsin, and so they suggested that Bernard and Ellen bring the two children and come to Wisconsin, because there was land to be had. And so they went. And they settled first along the Mississippi at Trimble, and had 5 more children in that little cabin. And then they moved to a bigger farm and house, and their family continued to grow. So they had 14 children in all when they went to Ukro, and they had the last 2.
Sure.
And then in 1904, which was the year that Father Solanus was ordained, the 2 of the boys, John and Tom, moved to the West Coast. They moved to Montana, and then Spokane, and then to Seattle. And then one by one, the rest of the family followed. So by 1918, the entire family, with the exception of the 3 priests, went to Seattle.
Mm-hmm. So 2 brothers were also priests?
Father Solanus, Father Morris, and Monsignor Ed.
So Father Solanus joined the Capuchins?
He joined the Capuchins.
And the other 2?
They were diocesan.
Yes.
Father Ed, who became a Monsignor, was a missionary in the Philippines.
Oh, is that right?
And it was the Bishop of Manila named him as a Monsignor because of his work with the schools in that area.
Yeah.
Then he was captured by the Japanese when the war broke out and was imprisoned for 3.5 years.
My goodness.
And was released on February 23rd, 1945.
Is that right? My, oh my. Yeah. So they would have kept very much in touch, I'm sure, those brothers, those priests.
Well, they tried to.
Yeah, as much as they could, especially during the war.
During the war.
Yeah, and praying for one another.
Yes.
So Solanus then He was a priest, but he didn't have the full faculties as a priest to preach or to hear confessions. And we'll come to Brother Richard Merlin. Okay. Could you tell us about the circumstances that he was a priest?
Well, Father, or Blessed Solanus Casey at the time, Father Solanus, was in the seminary, and he really struggled at that time, especially with Latin. So when it came time to actually ordain him, the superiors kind of felt that maybe there were a few things that maybe he wasn't totally educated with, but they decided that they would ordain him as a simplex priest, one who could basically say Mass and bless people and things of this sort, but not to hear confessions and to preach theological homilies.
Yeah, so it was a humble station for him as a priest.
It was a very humble station, yeah. Yes.
But given the character that we know of him, that was no great cross
right.
for him.
That's correct, yes, that he was very, a very humble person, and he accepted that. And I think that that's probably why God was able to use him as a tremendous healer.
Right. And well, brother, do we know when these extraordinary, the healings and the that were connected to him, when did that start, or how did that?
Well, they begin to notice that in his early years as priesthood, when he was out in Yonkers, New York.
And what was he the doorman at that time?
Or they had him as a doorman out there at that time. And when people were sick at home, he would go to visit them and bring them communion and the things of this sort. And it seemed like after his visit with them, people would feel much better. And so they noticed that these things were going on for a number of years. And so then they decided to transfer him to another parish in lower Manhattan to where...
They transferred him. It was in connection with those phenomena that they thought, this is a bit of notoriety that's maybe not in keeping with... a brother, and let's move him. Was that it?
Or? Well, it was just to the fact of wondering whether it was the people or if it was him.
So they were testing that?
They were testing it, yes.
Yes.
And that they found that the same thing was happening. And after 3 years at this other parish in lower Manhattan, they moved him to a Harlem area.
So they still weren't satisfied. They thought maybe it was just the piety of the people.
Right. And the same thing happened all over again, you know.
And in an increasing way, in the sense
in an increasing way, to a certain extent,
people who were being healed,
right? Yeah. And then after 3 years there, the superiors back in Detroit said, "Let's bring him here and see if these things continue to happen around him." And it did. In fact, just to give you an idea, was to the fact that when he first arrived in Detroit, the visitors to the front office of the monastery at St. Bonaventure's would be somewhere around maybe 10 to 15 people a day that would come in and ask for Mass cards or prayers. And after he was there for 2 weeks, our house chronicler writes in his notes, "Father Solanus Casey has been here for 2 weeks, and the numbers have increased to well over 200 people a day coming to the front office."
Extraordinary.
Yes.
So he was attracting well over what would normally be a community like that.
That's correct, yes, yes. Yeah. And that continued on for the next 20 years that he spent there in Detroit.
Is that right? So his ministry as such, if we could call it that, was supported then at that time by the community, and they were satisfied it was something of God rather than just a pious thing of ordinary people.
Definitely, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they found that out then by transferring him back to another little community out in New York State. And they thought they would kind of retire him out there. And within 9 months, they had to transfer him because of the crowds of people that were coming to him again.
Sure.
And so they transferred him to another community down in Huntington, Indiana, and which was really out in the country. And they just weren't expecting people to go see him. And before they know it, it ended up that there were... busloads of people coming from Detroit and Chicago to visit him.
Oh, so. Extraordinary. Yeah. I'm talking to Brother Richard Merlin and Sister Anne Herkenrath, and both are visiting from the United States and have connections with Blessed Solanus Casey. So what do we know of the spirituality of Solanus Casey in the sense of prayer and piety?
Well, he certainly was a very pious person, very prayerful. He was always very prayerful and so far as always being there for community prayer and would have daily mass. And he would spend many hours in prayer, especially at nighttime before the Blessed Sacrament. That was very important to him. And we as Capuchins had a tradition of praying with outstretched hands for maybe 2 or 3 minutes. But with Father Solanus, it was 2 or 3 hours and sometimes 4 or 5.
Wow.
And he would be just united with God in prayer. And the crucifix was a very special part of his prayer. And he was asked one time, Father, how do you pray? And he says, I unite myself with Jesus as he hung upon the cross.
Wow.
And you could see that he did that, and especially praying before the crucifix with his hands outstretched.
Really? And Father Benedict Rochelle knew him or met him at one stage.
Yes.
And I heard the story Father Benedict tells of not being able to sleep one night.
Mm-hmm.
And he went to the local parish church, mm-hmm. that he could just kneel outside where he could see the lamp of the tabernacle. And he became aware that someone was there, and it was Solanus Casey.
Yes.
And somehow, whatever Father Benedict did, he turned the lights on. But it was as if, he said, Solanus Casey didn't even notice.
Mm-hmm.
And was, right. I believe his hands were outstretched.
Yes.
This is in the wee hours of the morning.
Yes, yes.
And Father watched us for a while, and then he thought, gee, you know, I'm disturbing an important moment here. I better take myself off.
Right.
So that was a beautiful story.
Yeah, that was.
Completely
yeah.
anonymously, like yes. in the middle of the night.
Yes.
Here right. was this man. Yeah. This, yeah. You know, it's extraordinary.
Yeah. yeah. Sometimes that Father Solanus would be in chapel through the night, and maybe towards the end of the morning or that night time, he would lay down and just fall asleep on the floor. And when the friar would come in and awaken him, he would say, Father, you shouldn't have been sleeping on this hard floor. He said, I slept on the soft side of the boards. So he had a great sense of humor, really. He just knew how to...
Sure, sure. Now, it's interesting because he never heard confessions, yeah?
No, he didn't
hear
confessions.
He didn't have that faculty.
Many times people did say things to him, you know, thinking that they were going to confession, but he would simply say to them, you know, what you just told me, why don't you go over to the confessional there and go in and tell Father so-and-so the same thing,
yeah.
You know? They felt comfortable in telling the story or whatever there's... problem was with him, and so he was just kind of encouraging them to feel at peace and at ease as well to tell this story to the confessor.
Well, you know what, it strikes me that these days when everybody's kind of pushing for position in their state in life or whatever it is, and we see some of that maybe even in the priesthood with people, you know, I want to be a this or that, and here this wonderful saint who was obedient and was stuck to his station and didn't sort of protest, you know, gee, why don't you give me these faculties? Or people didn't even occur to them even to give him the faculties.
Right.
And maybe lesser ones who have the faculties, do you know? Mm-hmm. It's an interesting contrast.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. You know, Father Benedict Rochelle, I heard him say about Solanus Casey that he was a person who didn't have any ego.
Yes, you know? Yes, you could really say that, yes.
Yeah. Are there any particular stories you could tell us from people who encountered him who were either healed or had some transformation or something?
Mm-hmm. Father Solanus' position at St. Bonaventure's for a number of years, from 20 years, was as a doorkeeper or as the receptionist. And so a lot of people would come in with various stories, or situations in their lives that they would want to express to him and ask for his prayers. And there's one story of a young couple coming in with their young child who was 6 years of age, a boy, and they were carrying him. And they sat down on the chairs for their turn to come up to the desk and speak to Father Solanus. And When it came time for them to come up to the desk, only the mother came up to the desk and said to Father Solanas, you know, we have our son here and he's 6 years of age and he can't walk. And so she went on with the story and so forth. And when she finished, Father Solanas just simply looked over at the child and said, come here, little boy. And the mother spoke up right away and said, Father, I told you he doesn't walk. He said, come here, little boy. And the child got off the father's lap and walked over to the desk to him.
Wow. Wonderful. And I read that there were several thousand healings.
There would be, yes. And in fact, I'm sure they couldn't keep track of all of the healings that would take place. It was unbelievable.
Yeah. And was there a sense as well that he had wisdom in the sense of being able to talk to people, you know, minister to people and hearing their stories?
He did. He had a wisdom of knowing what was troubling them, what was going on in their lives.
So perhaps that maybe seeing souls a little bit, mm-hmm. reading souls.
Yes, reading souls, yes. And I just have a personal story, and it happened within our family, was to the fact that I have had an older brother that was in a serious auto accident and injured his leg, and they were going to amputate it. And so on Sunday afternoon, my mother said, let's go down and see Father Solanas. So we went down and met with Father Solanas, told him that my brother's, they were going to amputate his leg the next day. And he said, oh, don't worry, everything's going to be all right. And so my mother goes into the hospital the next day, and the doctors approach her and said, you know, we're not going to amputate his leg. We think it's going to be all right.
All right. Wonderful story.
So, yeah.
It's beautiful. Sister Anne, you have a story to tell us about your vocation. When you went to, you were trying to discern your vocation. Could you tell us that story? And you went to see Uncle Solanas.
I was discerning or trying to discern my vocation.
And when was this?
This was 1948.
Sister, can I ask a very rude question? How old are you?
Well, I'm 88 next month.
Is that right? Well, you're looking grand for 88, I have to say. It must be the Irish genes.
I think so. I think so.
So this is 1948.
This is 1948, and I was involved in many things through high school, but I had my eye set on a career of social work, and but I also had this nudging of a vocation, and it was tossing a coin this way or that way, and I just didn't know what to do. So when I was in Chicago visiting my aunt and uncle and my cousins, they took me down to Huntington, and we stayed the night at the monastery. And I thought, well, I've heard that, you know, Father Solanas knows things ahead of time. And so I thought, I'm going to get him off by myself. So I did. And I told him that I had some difficulties in making up my mind. And I says, you know, what do you think? Well, his blue eyes sparkled and a smile, big smile, and he turned to me and he says, that's between you and God. So he wasn't going to get involved with that one. And so I had to make up my own mind. And so now it's 70 years later, and I'm still a sister of the Holy Names.
And God give you the hard word.
So
that's a beautiful story. And sister, there was you were telling us as well in connection with the family. There's a beautiful poem or recitation that was written. Could you tell us that story?
Yes, the parents Bernard and Ellen had their Solanas Casey's parents had their golden wedding anniversary in 1913, celebrated in Seattle at Immaculate Conception Church, and of course. The children, all 14 of the living of the children that were still alive, were there, plus a number of the grandchildren that had come along.
And Solanas was there, and the
Solanas was there. Father Morris was there. Monsignor Ed was there. Well, he was Father Ed at that time, and they were all there. And Father Ed wrote this poem in honor of his parents for their golden wedding. And it's a poem that really sums up their family life with growing up, and to me it's very telling. It's I find it a very beautiful poem. There's so much family in it that I would like to recite.
I'd love to hear it.
Okay. This poem is entitled The Old Home, and it's written by Monsignor Edward F. Casey.
1913,
that's right. When we were young, the world was hung with beauty everywhere. We loved our home. We loved to roam mid woods and fields so fair. We tramped around St. Helen's Mound or herded cattle there. At night, we'd lark till through the dark, Dad's grand old voice called, "Prayer, prayer, boys." Then Mother led the prayers we said, though each in turn took part, and sweet became love's holy flame before the Sacred Heart. Dear Mother's face, with heaven's grace aglow, her modest eyes upraised or closed in peace reposed, her heart in paradise. And Father, too, so staunch and true, quick to defend the right, yet meek and mild as humblest child when we knelt down at night. To school we went, quite well content to learn the world of letters, and as we learned, our spirits burned away the dullard's fetters. We learned each rule in that old school, and then out to play and run. Sometimes we fought, but soon forgot our fury and our fun. We learned from brooks and hills and books and all the glowing earth, while limbs grew strong, life all a song of innocence and mirth. Each step, each look our teachers took was molding minds and hearts and shaping souls for varied roles in life's dramatic parts. And all the time, each tale, each rhyme, each story we'd explore was planting seeds of biting deeds that grow forevermore. They're with us still, for good or ill, they form our soul's deep sod to feed the self with pride or pelf or bind us close to God.
That's beautiful, sister. My goodness. And that's written by Salinas Casey's brother.
Father Ed.
And he read that in 1913.
Right.
At the Jubilee. Isn't that fantastic? And that's obviously passed right down through the family to this day.
It has. Well, Father Solanas said this prayer on a record that my dad had made in 1945.
So we have a recording of Solanas Case's voice.
Yes.
Reading that.
Reciting this poem. And I was enthralled with it and used it for a school. Something I had to memorize for school, and it's been kept close to my heart ever since.
Beautiful. Yeah. I'm talking to Brother Richard Merlin and Sister Anne Herkenrath, and both are visiting from the United States and have connections with Blessed Solanas Casey. So, what about towards the end of his life? He had some significant illnesses, didn't he?
Well, yes. One of the things was that he had a skin disease that kind of covered his whole body at his last days. And it was to a point to where they put him into the hospital. He was in the hospital, I think he went in on July 2nd or 3rd, 1957. And he remained there until July the 31st.
And it would have been a terrible, itchy and uncomfortable.
Yes, very uncomfortable. And when he was in the hospital there, the last day or two, of course, his brother, Monsignor Ed, had come out and was staying with him along, I believe, with another sister. I'm not too sure who it was.
Aunt Martha. Owen's wife.
Okay. And so the two of them were kind of taking turns and being with Father through those days. And although he did get up out of his bed and walked around a little bit, down the hall and so forth, and would go back into bed. And then on his last day, he was very weak and just very little life in him at all. And around 11 o'clock in the morning, he all of a sudden began to rally a bit, and he raised himself up in bed and simply said, "I give my soul to Jesus Christ," and laid back down and died.
My, oh my. And I understand there was just the nurse there with him, isn't that right?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. What a way to die, my goodness.
Right, yeah. But the whole thing, you know, he was just with God at that point, you know. That's very right. Definite.
That's right, that's right.
So convinced.
And then immediately the word got around. And can you tell us about the funeral of Salamis Keyser?
Well, the word got around very quickly. Of course, it was in the newspapers all over.
How well would he have been known at that time?
Very well known, because of the fact that during his time of being laid out there one day and one night at the monastery, they figured there were close to 20,000 people came to view him.
Yeah.
And, of course, a good thousands were there at the funeral itself. In fact, our own family was on vacation at the time in Upper Michigan, which was about 350 miles away. And at that time, when we just happened to open up the paper and there was an article, Father Salamis Keyser dies. And my mother says, we're going home. So we packed up from our vacation and went back down home to Detroit and so that we could be there at the funeral.
Wow. And sister, were you at the funeral as well, and your family?
No, I wasn't. Well, my family didn't go from Seattle, but Jim's mother and a couple of cousins who were living on the East Coast was there.
Yeah, yeah. But it would have been very, very significant for the family when you heard that the old uncle had died.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. And very quickly, am I right, that the miracles didn't cease?
That's right.
Yeah.
They continued. And we kept hearing more stories about the happenings with Father Salamis.
Yeah, yeah. And then right up, there was a point in time where they exhumed the body of Salamis Keyser. Isn't that right? Could you tell us about that?
Well, it was back in 1987, they exhumed his body.
For what reason?
Basically, it was to look at, to see what was still remaining. As far as his body.
Were they going to move him?
They were moving him as well. They moved him from outdoors to indoors and moved him into the church. And that was to make it more comfortable for people coming to his gravesite, because in all types of inclement weather, there were just many, many people that would be coming in to visit his tomb outside or his grave. So they felt that it would be very appropriate to have him brought into church.
Because of this growing devotion to him and people wanting to visit.
Yes, definitely. The devotion was just growing, and it hadn't, you might say it hadn't stopped from the day that he was alive, you know.
Yeah.
It just continued on with the numbers of people coming. And so it was to make it convenient for them. And so we brought him into church, and at that time it was rather kind of an interesting thing that happened insofar as they opened up the casket and everything, and his body was much the way he was the day he had been buried.
Yeah.
And it was a beautiful scene. Mm-hmm. Supposedly, it was to have been kept very quiet, that there wasn't to be it wasn't to be known that he was being exhumed because they didn't want the public. Well, they tried to do that as much as possible, and we have a back chapel to where the body was laid out at and examined and so forth, and then they put him into a new casket. And when they brought him out into the church where they were going to place him into the ground or into a little altar area, we were dumbfounded to find the church packed with people. Word of mouth got around that Father Salamis was being exhumed that day, and so they just flocked to the church, you know.
Yeah.
And but anyways, then he was buried there, and he'd been there for 30 years. And this past, it's a little over a year ago now that they did exhume it the first of the year in January. They exhumed the body, and the body was still well preserved.
Beautiful.
And that made it a little more convenient for people to visit now, and the casket can be seen. It's not covered over and things of this sort.
Yeah. And sister, you viewed Uncle Salamis, the remains, am I right?
I did.
I did.
Well, first of all, just to back up, this was all supposed to be very, very quiet. And when Brother Leo Wollenweber called and asked me to be there, he says, now don't tell anybody, tell your superior, but nobody else. So I didn't tell anybody. About 2 days before I was to leave, I get a phone call from one of our sisters in Detroit who said, "Anne, they're going to exhume Father Solanas. The family better know and they better be here." Well, I couldn't tell her that I was going to be there.
Yeah.
So I just said, "Oh, thank you. I'll look into that."
Sure.
And so after it was all finished, I called Sister and I said, "I was here."
Yeah. And what did you observe about Solanas?
Well, first of all, the interior of the casket was in shreds. And yet, Father Solanas was still recognizable. I would have known him anyplace.
Yeah.
And it was just an awesome, grace-filled moment to be there. I'm forever grateful to the Capuchins for bringing me into the picture.
Yeah, it must have been remarkable to
it
see
was.
Him.
It
yeah,
was.
All of those years later, and just as he was.
Well, then they lifted him out of the old casket and examined him and put a new robe on him and put him back into a new casket. But at one point, everybody broke for lunch, but I stayed with him in the room. And it was just there. His hands and forearms had become bone, but that was about the only thing that had disintegrated. But I just held his hands, and, you know, it was just overwhelming.
I'm sure it was. My, oh, my. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he was made venerable, and then he was made blessed, which is one step before the canonization. Brother Richard, do you want to tell us anything about that process or how that came about?
Well, in order for the next step after being referred to as venerable, then we were to be looking for a healing that might be credited to him as being miraculous. And we had a lot of reports. There's constantly people coming to us saying that they feel that they've been healed and this and that has taken place in their lives through the intercession of Father Solanas. But you really have to delve into one particular case and really look at it, examine it. And so with that, there was a situation where we had a lady from Panama who was visiting one of our friars who had been a missionary down there. And she was up from Panama visiting some relatives in Detroit. So she came to the monastery, and she was staying there at the monastery overnight. And on a Saturday morning, she got up, and they were had been talking about Father Solanas and so forth, and the miraculous person that he was, and saintly. And she herself had had a skin disease since childhood. And it was all over her body, basically. And she went out to the tomb where Solanas is and knelt down and prayed. And she had heard from the rest of us, you know, how people would come and ask for prayers. And so she was praying for a number of her friends who were sick down in Panama. And after she finished her prayer for them, she was ready to get up and walk away. And a voice, inner voice, spoke to her and said, "And what about yourself? What about yourself?" Mm-hmm. So she knelt back down and prayed for her own condition that she had had since childhood. And she was into her 50s, and so it had never changed one way or the other. So she just wouldn't have expected that. And she began to realize that she felt a funny sensation through her body. And she went back to the guest quarters, to the room that she was in. And she realized that the skin, that this disease was just falling off of her body.
Just sort of immediately?
Immediately.
Wow.
And in fact, she scooped some up and put it into a towel, and she came to my office to show me what had happened to her.
Wow, so you witnessed this, right?
So I witnessed it, yes.
Wow. It's extraordinary.
Yes, it is, yes.
And was that that went through the process of, with regard to Rome and to see that it was a miracle?
Yes, it did. It took probably a good four years before it was really approved. But it had to go through a process. It went through, the lady was brought back up from Panama and questioned, and her doctors from Panama came up and things like that to give testimony that, yes, she had had this for all these years, and they would have never expected it to have been healed. And yeah. So there was a lot of investigation into the whole case itself.
Very thoroughly investigated.
Very thoroughly, yes.
Yeah. What a grace for you to see out up close.
Yes, it was. It was really a very special blessing to see this.
Yeah. So finally, where's the cause at now?
Well, the cause now, we're looking for another healing, something that can be proven and very definite, that would move him on to becoming sainted. He would end up being a saint, canonized. So that's our...
So if anybody has any favors that they've received that might be in that category, to let you know.
Right, yes.
And how can they get in touch with you?
Well, they can write to myself, Brother Richard Merling, OFM CAP, and Vice Postulator of the Cause of Blessed Solanus Casey.
Yeah, wonderful. Yeah. I'm talking to Brother Richard Merlin and Sister Anne Herkenrath, and both are visiting from the United States and have connections with Blessed Solanus Casey. Well, Sister, just finally, he was an Irishman.
Mm.
And,
yes.
So while he had this great piety, he's always had a bit of crack. He played the violin and sang a few songs. I understand there were Irish tunes that he played, yeah?
Well, he did. I know Mother McCree was one of them.
Uh-huh.
He played a number of tunes, and I don't know what they were, but they were tunes. And just going back to his childhood, he used to play for the barn dances that were held in his the family barn after he had picked up this violin. And so on Saturday night, he was in demand for these teenage family gatherings.
Yeah. That's wonderful. And I understand he sang a few songs for penance to the brothers around him at times. Is that right? His voice wasn't perhaps John McCormick.
His voice was pretty raspy. But he had the raspy voice because a diphtheria epidemic went through the countryside. And two of his little sisters died of it in 1 week's time.
Wow.
And several of the others were also hit by the disease. But just the two died. But he was left with a very scratchy, raspy voice, which he died with. You know, it was still, he didn't ever get over that raspy voice, but it came from the diphtheria.
Brother Richard, you had some experience too with regard to the violin playing of Solanus Casey.
Yes, in our visit with Father Solanus on that Sunday and asking for prayers for my brother, at the end of that little conversation, he simply said, you know, he says, I just restrung a violin this morning. He says, I'd like to play it for you. So he went off to his room and brought back this violin in hand and played several tunes for us. And we thought it was wonderful. And then it ended up that... when I entered the order and I said to the brother, and I said, oh, I got to hear Father Solanus play his violin. And they all kind of said, yes, and so did we. And plugged their ears. But they said that he would take the violin when they knew that he was entertaining them in any way, that he would take the violin and go off to chapel and stand before one of the statues and play it.
Isn't that
to one
great?
Of the saints. So.
Oh, that's wonderful. He obviously got great pleasure out of that. You know?
Yes, right. As I said, he had a captured audience hearing it before one of the statues.
Yeah, I think it was his violin playing that got the brothers. However, one of my cousins, who was a music teacher, said, well, you know, he played pretty much in tune. It just was scratchy and didn't have the tone, but the tune was all right.
He was an Irishman. He had that bit of a rough edge about him, you see.
Yes.
So Sister Anne Herkenrath, the grandniece of Solanus Casey, and Brother Richard Merlin, who's the vice postulator and also a relation to Blessed Solanus Casey. So bless you for coming to Ireland, and please God, we'll see you again sometime.
That would be great. It would be wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Celtic Connections with Cathy Sinnott.
Kathy Sinnott next time for more Celtic Connections.